supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
No, they can't hear you now, and they haven't for years. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Verizon New Jersey has reached a settlement with 17 South Jersey towns over complaints of lousy phone and internet service. From WHYY's New Jersey desk, Joe Hernandez reports that not everyone thinks it's a good solution.
Verizon will take a more aggressive approach toward maintaining its copper wires in South Jersey and make it easier for towns to apply for its fiber-based Fios broadband coverage. Under the agreement, the telecom giant will also set new customer service and performance standards and report regularly to the State Board of Public Utilities on whether it's falling short. Ray McConville is a Verizon spokesman.
We have heard our customers' concerns in South Jersey, and they're pleased to have reached an agreement with their approval of all 17 towns on a maintenance plan going forward.
Cumberland County and 17 South Jersey towns filed a formal complaint with the state in 2015, alleging that Verizon was failing to maintain its copper network. The towns also blamed the company for refusing to offer more modern options like Fios to residents in the largely rural area. Stephanie Brand runs the Division of Rate Council, which advocates on behalf of utility customers. She says the settlement is not perfect, but it forces Verizon to make good on its promises.
Our choice really was to try to get something in place that had enforceable provisions or to just allow the case to languish.
The settlement still needs the approval of the State Board of Public Utilities, but not everybody is applauding it.
We can't survive if we are continually left behind.
Greg Facemeyer is a committeeman in Hopewell Township, Cumberland County, one of the towns that is part of the settlement. He's a big critic of Verizon and says that a lot of people will still go without quality phone and internet service if the Board of Public Utilities signs off on this deal.
Unfortunately, the BPU continues to allow Verizon to pick and choose which residents will receive modern technology and telecommunications at an affordable price.
The BPU has not said when it will vote on the proposed settlement. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
In Allegheny County, five jurors have been chosen for the sexual assault trial of Bill Cosby. WESA's Mark Newtbar reports.
Of the 100 potential jurors in this morning's pool, 37 were immediately struck by agreement between the prosecution and the defense. Another 21 were questioned, with several being dismissed for cause. However, the defense had to use four of its seven preemptive strikes, meaning it did not have to offer a reason for excluding them from service. The prosecution used two of its strikes. Of the five jurors chosen, three are males and all are white. Cosby is charged with drugging and assaulting a woman in his suburban Philadelphia home. The jury is being selected in Allegheny County, but will be bused to Montgomery County for the trial next month. I'm Mark Newtbar in Pittsburgh.
Drug users desperate to kick the habit are now turning to some New Jersey police departments for help. WHYY's Phil Gregory reports on a program that's having some success in the battle against opioid addiction.
These people have reached that bottom, I guess, and want the help. The first few came in. I guess they tested the waters to see that we were actually telling them the truth. We weren't trying to set them up. Others have come in, and I guess the word is getting out that we'll actually get them the help they're looking for. It's not a trick.
That's Brick Township Police Chief James Riccio. He says about 150 drug users showed up at police stations in Brick and Manchester Township since the Heroin Addiction Response Program was launched in January. Participants don't need to have insurance coverage. The program is funded with drug forfeiture money. When they walk in, instead of facing arrest, the chief says there's a brief assessment.
We'll ask them questions about the type of drug and type of addiction that they've had, when they've last used, just so it'll help the assessors better determine what type of treatment they need.
After that initial process, they're transported to a treatment facility where a clinician evaluates whether they should have inpatient or outpatient treatment or detox. Ocean County Prosecutor Joseph Coronado says the perception that police just want to prosecute drug users instead of helping them started to change with the advent of Narcan, When administered quickly, it can reverse an overdose from heroin or other opioids.
When we brought Narcan here in Ocean County back in 2014, we were the first county to do it. I think the image of the police officer just arresting our way out of the problem wasn't successful for the last 40 years. Here we save lives right from the very beginning, but just because you administer Narcan does not make that you're going to break the cycle of addiction.
Coronado says so far about 80% of the users who seek help at police stations are sticking with the recovery program. He credits that success to the recovery coaches who follow patients throughout the process.
Because we have that live human being, that mentoring program attached to it, I think our rate has changed, because if they all of a sudden have some sort of psychological or have a problem along the way, there's someone else like a lifeline that they can reach out to, that they can talk to, who they can relate to, that gets them back on track.
Brick Township Mayor John Ducey says getting people into treatment benefits the community as well.
The users, a lot of the times, they're the ones who are doing some of the petty crimes, opening car doors and stealing the change out of a car and things like that. Now, if they're able to get help and get rehabilitation and become a productive member of society again, it adds a lot to our battle against this unfortunate scourge of heroin.
The program is being expanded to Stafford Township. Similar efforts are underway at police departments in West Orange, Paramus, Mahwah, and Lyndhurst. Ocean County Prosecutor Coronado says even more towns in the state might want to set up that kind of program, but it's not easy.
When somebody walks in, they walk into our police station carrying their valises, their suitcase, they're prepared to do something. As a result of that, you can't say come back tomorrow. You can't say wait 6 hours. You have to have the available detox beds and the available treatment beds so we can handle the volume as it comes in.
Law enforcement officials say the program is an important component of combating the opioid epidemic and hope it might help reduce overdose deaths. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Phil Gregory, WHYY News.
The Trump administration is proposing eliminating a student loan forgiveness program. It granted relief to government workers, teachers, police officers, nonprofit employees, and others who work in public service. Trump's top education department officials say the savings from ending the program will in turn be directed toward boosting their school choice agenda, so pumping more resources into charter schools and vouchers for students at private and religious schools. WHYY's Bobby Allen joins me to take up the history of the Public Service Forgiveness Program and what it means for the Philadelphia area. But first, Bobby, let's start with a disclosure.
Yeah, Dave. So as someone who graduated from a pricey college with federal student loan debt and someone who now works at WHYY, which is a nonprofit, I qualify. And I'm actually currently enrolled. So I do have kind of a personal stake in the future of this program. But I'm far from alone, right? There are more than 900 public radio stations in the country, not to mention the many thousands who are employed as public defenders, prosecutors, teachers, public health workers. As you mentioned, many people qualify for this program. In fact, the government says up to a quarter of all jobs in the U.S. are eligible for public service forgiveness. In the Philadelphia area, many people got into public service to begin with because of this forgiveness program. One of those people is Alex Turpin. He's a 31-year-old social worker based at a clinic just north of Princeton.
Part of the incentive for me is I'll agree to take a lower pay if it means that I get to, A, work with this population, but, B, I get to qualify for loan forgiveness at the end of, you know, those 10 years.
So Turpin told me most of his clients are really needy patients. Some of them have been diagnosed with conditions like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. They're in and out of hospitals frequently. It's a population, Turpin says, he really wants to work with. But given his $70,000 of student loan debt, he says it's only sustainable if he can receive student loan relief.
Bobby, take us back to the onset of the program and what was the intent?
Sure. So it was a bipartisan effort back in 2007. So that was on the heels of the Great Recession. The forgiveness for public service workers was just one piece of a huge law that made more money available to student loan borrowers. Basically, its intent was to encourage more people to go into public service. It was kind of seen as a GI Bill for teachers, police officers, nonprofit workers, and the like. A Democratic congressman sponsored it, and President Bush signed it into law.
So why now does the Trump administration want to get rid of it?
So their motivation for getting rid of it isn't really clear at this point. But in the Department of Education's leaked budget, one theme is very clear: huge cuts across the board. Some economists have worried that forgiving billions of dollars in student loan debt over the next generation or so would have some unintended consequences, like maybe incentivizing graduate students from taking out eye-popping federal loans. So perhaps Trump's policy people are concerned about that. Sarah Goldrick-Robb is a professor at Temple's College of Education. She is against eliminating the public service forgiveness program. She says we don't need people in underpaid public interest jobs feeling worse about their future.
So anything that we can do to try to reduce that stress is important, and it's not government's role to exacerbate that stress by messing with a program that, by all accounts, has been doing a job that's important.
Bobby, also speak to the concern that if the program scrapped, so-called do-good jobs might have a harder time attracting candidates.
Yeah, that's definitely the fear, Dave. Natalia Abrams leads the advocacy group Student Debt Crisis. She says many employers have contacted her since this news came out, really worried about trying to find candidates.
It's going to make it harder for nonprofits to recruit because often don't have a lot of money to pay the best salaries for how valuable our employees are. And so one of the perks was this program.
We don't know yet whether eliminating this forgiveness program is going to make it into the final budget. And if it does, we also don't know whether those currently enrolled will be grandfathered in or not. But once I know more, Dave, I'll be back with updates.
Thanks, Bobby.
Thank you, Dave.
WHYY's Bobby Allen on NewsWorks Tonight. Longwood Gardens, the historical botanical estate in Kennett Square, Pennsylvania, is about to reopen its centerpiece fountain garden. The five-acre garden has been closed for almost 3 years as it's been rebuilt. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that the 17th century garden is powered by 21st century technology.
Every piece of carved limestone with the fountain garden at Longwood, there are 4,000 pieces, was removed and sent to conservators. Every underground pipe installed 85 years ago was dug up so that an entirely new underground infrastructure could be built at a cost of $90 million. For the better part of 2 years, the garden had basically been a massive hole in the ground. And that was okay with Tori Frausto, who visits Longwood almost every week with her children.
It's been fun. Well, we have three boys, so they've been loving the bulldozers and the trucks, and that's almost as much fun, if not more, than the flowers for them lately.
The people who run Longwood Gardens call this an engineer's garden. It was designed by Pierre Dupont of the Dupont Fortune, who trained as a chemical engineer. CEO Paul Redmond says Dupont took the concept of a 17th century classical European water garden and built it with the latest technology.
He was looking to the future. I mean, it's a he built what is considered the modern-day DuPont Corporation. And so very forward-thinking individual. But he was a classicist at the same time. He loved the classical water gardens of Italy and France, and he loved the English countryside gardens.
In 1931, when this garden was built, DuPont was one of the first people to illuminate water with electric lights. He made one of the finest mechanically choreographed water performances in the world. But that was over 80 years ago. Not only had the system deteriorated, and some parts have not been operational since the 1980s, but new technology would make the fountain more spectacular and easier to maintain. For example, DuPont had designed the surrounding landscape of Longwood Gardens with a system of water pools that fed hundreds of thousands of gallons into the fountains. And now the entire water supply is self-contained in a 400,000-gallon underground cistern. That means the fountains are less susceptible to winter weather, extending the performance season.
We absolutely honored the legacy of our founder in his original design intent. I have no doubt that if he were standing on the overlook looking at this garden right now, it would look very familiar to him. He would know this garden. But we also know that if he were here today and he was faced with having to bring new life to this garden, he would be looking at the latest and greatest technology.
Redmond put everything back where it was and added a few new elements to the garden, including a hidden stone grotto. Even the original pumping system DuPont personally designed remains exactly where it was. The old pump house with 15 mechanical pumps has been converted into a museum. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Heading into the Memorial Day weekend, there are many anniversaries of note in the world of science and astronomy. Let's count them off with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, Perhaps it's a stretch to say mankind or kind of man went into space in 1959.
Well, you could at least talk about the class of animal, perhaps. It was on May 28th that the first primates flew into space. The chimpanzees Abel and Baker both made suborbital flights. Now, they were in capsules. The intention was to bring them back. They were well cared for. And at least one of them actually lived into a ripe old age, actually.
Was NASA the United States' first to launch primates into space?
Yes, indeed. And, of course, we use the information that came out of that mission to better understand what the risks would be for humans to travel into space, chimpanzees being closer cousins. And so, interestingly enough, it was 2 years later on May 25th that then-President John F. Kennedy gave his now famous moon landing speech, in which he said before the decade is out, we would like to have landed Americans on the moon and bring them back safely.
Part science, part politics.
Well, you know, depending which lens you look at this through, it may be more politics and less science, although the technology was necessary because of the intercontinental ballistic missile race that was happening at the time that turned into the space race between the United States and the Soviet Union. And to cap this off, it was absolutely 100% necessary to show that we had domination in both categories of human space flight and the intercontinental ballistic missile race. So by putting people on the moon, it allowed us to sort of close out that chapter and that race, even though by the time we had landed on the moon in 1969, the Russians had long since given up the race. Now, May 22nd, 1969, Apollo 10, a manned mission to the moon, descended to within 50,000 feet of the lunar surface in a dress rehearsal for the first manned landing on the moon. That was to come up 60 days later, accomplished by Apollo 11 in July of 1969.
50,000 feet, about 10 miles.
It was an extraordinary view, but can you imagine being the astronauts that were tantalized with being so close to the surface of the moon? And they aren't the ones to go.
Did any of that crew subsequently return to and land on the moon?
Well, it was actually Tom Stafford, Gene Cernan, and John Young who were on that mission. And it was John Young and Gene Cernan who actually had the opportunity to land and walk on the moon in subsequent missions. And in fact, Gene Cernan was the last astronaut to leave the moon. Apollo 17, Gene Cernan passed away just last year.
Gene probably didn't realize that he would have that distinction lasting to this day.
It is really amazing that we have not returned to the moon with manned missions since then, but hopefully that will be sometime in the not-too-distant future.
Derek, we won't sing it, but sunrise, sunset, and those sunsets are coming later and later.
In fact, in my mind, it's one of the best times of the year because sunrise is occurring in this part of the world at about 5:39 in the morning. Sunset occurs at 8:15 in the evening. We have 14 hours, 36 minutes of daylight, which is really fabulous. And yet we still have another 30 minutes of daylight to add to the day because we're working our way within about 3 or 4 weeks of the summer solstice coming up on June 21st. So we still have more sunlight to gain. So we can see this primarily in the earlier and earlier rising time of the sun. We still have 30 minutes on the end of the day that we can pick up because sunset, by the time we get to that point, will be coming at around 8:30 in the evening, 8:35 in the evening. So still more time to be gained.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.